Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of Brown Car Guy and Buddies. And today I'm going to be talking to a very dear friend of mine, Neville Darukhanewala. In fact, if you have been following this series of Brown Car Guy and Buddies, then I think it was about a couple of months ago, I actually did an amazing chat with his older brother, Adil Jal Darukhanewala, who is essentially India's top, most established, most well-known motoring journalist. And this is his equally well-known younger brother, who has done all kinds of things, from winning two championships on two wheels in India and traversing most of Africa, about 10,000 kilometers on a scooter. I, of course, got to know him when he was a journalist in Dubai. When I moved out there in 2006, he'd already been there. He's been in the UAE for a while now. And he quickly transitioned to the dark side, as we call it, to the PR side. So we're going to catch up with all of that and see how that happened and how his journey was. He's got lots of great stories to tell, so this should be fantastic. Before we get into that, make sure that you are subscribing to this channel. This is youtube.com/browncarguy. Make sure that you are following me on all of my social media channels. Just search for hashtag browncarguy. That's on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And of course, subscribe to browncarguy.com. Cool, let's get into this. Hey Neville, how you doing? It has been ages, buddy. How you been keeping?
Hey, I've been doing okay. You looking good, Shehzad. I think the cold weather in England is suiting you rather than the heat from the sandpit.
No, I hate it actually. I'd rather come back to the heat.
You know what?
We've been having some good weather, so it's okay. I'm all right at the moment.
You know what? I don't mind swapping places.
Yeah. I think the grass is eternally greener, right?
Absolutely. It's just about hovering between 42 and 48 degrees over here. So,
oh my lord,
but you know, so nice. And
but I can remember doing, you know, I can remember doing TV shoots in 50 degrees heat, wearing a tie and a jacket. So I'm like, you know,
I've done events in 50 degrees. So yeah, it's okay. You get used to it. You should get used to it after being here for about 19 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. We'll come back to that. I mean, how's it been? Just because I always ask everybody, like, how's lockdown been? Because obviously that's a big topic in everybody's mind at the moment. How have you coped with the whole situation?
Well, it's, in a way, it's good. Got to spend a lot more time with the family and the dog.
All right.
Been cooking, being fed some nice food by the missus. So,
Have you been doing some baking?
No baking.
Everybody's been doing baking. What's that all about?
No baking. Only cooking food. Some good Indian food. And some continental. Yeah, it was good.
Go on, tell us what you've been making.
My favorite is mince. Uh-huh. So, in fact, I just made it yesterday.
All right, can I have some?
Well, let me try and share it through the screen. No, my son loves it, so that and, you know, normal stuff like some biryanis and stuff.
Right. Are you a good cook then? You bet.
My wife is staring at me from the other corner of the room.
she's like, choose your words very carefully.
Absolutely.
In any case, you're probably a million times better cooked than I am. I can basically fry an egg. That's about it. So I can cook. So we have known each other pretty much since I was there. I mean, I joined there in 2006 in Dubai. We must have met on some event. You were still a journalist at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, those were my last years of journalism before I switched over to the dark side.
I
still remember that one Ford gig when you turned up in the GM truck.
Yeah, they didn't like that for some reason.
I guess so. There are some good times, weren't there? In the old days.
There's been a lot of moments. But cast your mind back. I mean, because I spoke one of these, for regular people that have been watching these, I did one of the first ones, or I think the first or the second one I did of these, this Brown Car Guy and Buddy series, was actually with your brother.
Yes, I know.
And you kind of started out with him, didn't you? And very early on.
I did. We started. I started my journalism career in 1987. Well, actually, we started '86, and our first issue came out in June of '87. And yeah, I mean, since then, it's just been one good. Not, I wouldn't call it a roller coaster ride, but a great few rides.
So how did you get into it? I mean, did Adil, your brother Adil, did he just kind of drag you into this, or were you also, you know, as much of a petrol head as he was?
Well, I used to race. I started racing way back in 1984. But before that, I used to help him organize races back home. We used to have the Rodil Trophy, the Supercross World Championship round, one of the rounds. And we used to have a yearly Supercross back home in Pune, in India.
So this is this was two wheels or four wheels? What are we talking
two
now?
Two wheels, motocross.
Motocross. So this is, we're talking bikes. Yeah. What sort of bikes are we talking?
So we're talking on off-road bikes.
Right.
You don't know motocross.
I don't know anything about bikes, honestly. But yeah. just in case people watching do know about bikes, then you can tell them.
So we used to have this in a stadium. So it was known as Supercross because it was famous in the States. And we used to organize international race every year. And then we had a world championship round too. So I used to help him. So I was always in bikes at that time. And then my brother used to had a very big scrapbook, which he used to fill up, and he used to buy magazines, cut the pictures, stick them in, write his own stories about them. Yeah. And he used to write in the newspapers, as you know, he spoke about it.
Yeah.
And whatever bits and scraps he did not want, he threw them to me. So I had my own scrapbook and I used to do the same thing.
One of the stories you told me, I remember this, it was a while back, and it was a wonderful story, how you guys would go around to all of the old bookshops and magazine shops and just desperately try and find anything. You tell it better.
So yeah, so we didn't have much money, so...
Paint a picture, where was this,
I'm coming to that. So we didn't have much money, so my brother would somehow manage to scrounge some few bucks from here, there, and keep on building up and make a little bit of a cash cachet. And then he say, okay, come on, off we go to all the what we would call the raddi shops, you know, the used magazine stores. And we
and where,
would find
where would they be?
So
where
earlier would... we would go around town in Pune where we lived. And then when we exhausted all those places, we would take a train to Bombay and walk around all day in search of you know, these small little tucked away in one corner shops, and ask them for some automotive books. Okay, say, do you have some car books or bike books? And you'll be surprised. We used to find owner's manuals and technical books from the 50s, 60s.
Wow.
And then the bargaining would start.
Yeah.
And we would come back home in the evening, catch the train back from Bombay in the evening and get back. I was basically taken by my brother to carry all the stuff. He was a slave driver, I tell you. So
that's why you've got a stooped back. That's why I see that. I realize now.
Yeah. And then we used to come back, and then in those days there was no internet.
Yeah.
And then
so around what year was this?
This was late 70s, early 80s.
Right. And how old were you?
I was just out of school, so I was 16 or 17.
Wow. And so you two used to go off on your own to Bombay in a train?
No, I used to go with him.
Yeah.
I used to go with Adil.
Yeah.
And the two of us would go.
How much older is he than you?
He's 11 years older than me.
Oh, okay. So he was a responsible adult.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You could call that, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and then he used to write letters to, I forget the guy, Eon Young. And some other journalists, because in Motor Magazine, I think if I'm right, on the last page, Yeon Young had a column.
Right.
And he would always ask for if anybody had any old owner's manuals, technical books, stuff
yes.
like that.
Yes, yes.
And we used to find these.
Wow.
And he used to write to them and say, I've got A, B, C, D, right up till Z. And Yeon Young would write back, which we would get the mail back after 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say, okay, I'll pay you £3.50 for this book,
yeah.
you know, £10 for this book.
Yeah.
And then we used to, my brother would say, please send the money, half the money in advance so I can parcel it to you. And that's how we used to do it. That was great fun, good fun.
There's quite a little business going on. So I mean, like, what was the how much was that worth in terms of like you? I mean, how much did you pick it up for, and how much were you managing to sell it to Yeon Young for?
Well, at times you would pick up some books for as less as 2 rupees, 5 rupees, 10 rupees, and we would get maybe £20 for a 2 rupee book, or maybe a £50, maybe sometimes. Yeah. Even more than that, it depends on the condition of the book and wow. how rare it was. So the money that he would get from selling these journals back to England, he would invest some of the money to go and buy magazines from a bookstore,
right,
because
right.
it had the list of all the, so we
right.
knew what we had to look for.
It
made it so much easier, you know. But it was great fun.
So question. So how did these books and magazines and all of this stuff that you were finding that were so obviously so valuable to a journalist like him, how were they ending up in India in the first place? How would they get there?
Because a lot of British cars, American cars were at one point, they had dealerships in India, and a lot of these manuals were there.
Right.
And they were just thrown. You
wow.
know, nobody knew the value of them, their value. So they were just chucked. They were just sold as scrap by the kilo.
That's amazing. You know? So do you think that there would still be, if young kids watching this now, would there still be that
for
opportunity?
Sure.
Really?
For sure. I would think so.
So it's just a case of spending the time to go and...
Spending the time. That's correct.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
correct.
Yeah.
For
wow.
sure. Definitely.
There's an opportunity for people who want to get onto eBay with something special, right?
Yeah. Well, if eBay would have been there that time, my brother would have made a killing.
Oh my God! Can you imagine?
Not that he didn't.
Yeah.
Not that he didn't, but yeah. you know, he would have made more money. Yeah, for sure.
So
but yeah, that was my initiation.
So moving forward, then, so you started. So how did you then get into the magazine, and just from the racing, or then you started to do something? You thought, okay, we get all of these magazines. Why don't we do our own or something like that?
Yeah, my brother used to, like you would have from his talk,
yeah.
He used to write for the local newspapers
yeah.
and stuff. So he was trained to do something else.
Right.
I think he was a millwright mechanic.
Right, right.
His heart was not in it. He wanted to write.
Mm.
And because he used to have this big scrapbook at home and he used to keep on writing, he made me also do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then... we decided to start the magazine and ask my uncle's help for it.
Yeah.
And he sort of roped me in and he says, fine, you're going to work with me. And, you know, and that's how it started.
That's
it was good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you continue the racing along? Cause you had what, 2 championships from what?
Right. So, in 1987, we were part of the Bajaj Auto factory team, which my brother again put together. And the first time that a scooter with the engine on one side of the chassis was racing. There were other guys who raced such bikes, such scooters, but without much success. So we went in with and entered 2 categories, 150cc category and 100cc category. So I, being a junior rider, I was in the 100cc. My senior colleagues were in the 150. And at that time, the Lambrettas were just winning anything and everything in sight. Not that we had too many road races in India. We had just 2 or 3 tracks, old airfields converted into racing tracks. We raced in 86 first, and then I won.
Wow.
It was a mixed field. We had a 80cc class the 100cc scooter class and 150cc scooter class.
How many
and
bikes
a 200cc scooter
class. How many bikes are on the track at the same time?
So at that point, the grid must have been about between 40 and 50 bikes.
40
and
50
I think,
bikes.
If I remember correctly, I came. Yeah.
You came. What,
if I remember
sorry?
Correctly.
Yeah, go on.
I'm trying to remember. Overall, I think I came about 10th or 11th, and so, first in class.
So this was,
but
this
the
was,
guys
this was the
before
first
me.
Time, this was the first time you were out there in this race situation.
That's correct.
What must it be
in,
like
on a scooter on a road racing?
What must it be like to be in that environment where suddenly there's 40, 50 angry racers around you? This is the first time you're doing it, and you managed to even come 10th in that. That's incredible.
No, 10th overall and first in class.
Wow. But it must have been pretty freaky, though. It must have been pretty scary.
Oh, yeah. It's good fun. I mean, some places it's good elbow-to-elbow racing, diving into corners and stuff.
I'm guessing FIA standard safety wasn't necessarily a prerequisite.
No, it wasn't. But you know what? Those days, the racing was so much better. It was so much fun because you could just come out and race and show your talent. Later on, as with too much regulations, as we have seen over year two in Dubai,
it
just kills the sport. So we used to have really massive grids for every category of racing.
Yeah.
And it was great fun.
My goodness. And then something else I wanted to ask you about that you did afterwards. I think you did it in 1990. You did this big expedition.
Yes.
Tell me about that. That's an incredible story. I want you to tell it. Tell me, how did that come about and what actually was it?
Right. So one day, Adil and myself were sitting down at his in his flat, and we were watching some VHS cassettes of the Paris-Dakar rally.
Wow.
And we were watching, and we had the magazine going at that time, and suddenly something struck. And we started talking that one of the manufacturers, which had a collaboration with Honda in India called Kinetic Engineering, sales were not really shooting up the roof. So, and they had spoken with Adil to figure out some event or something to give a boost to the product. And we were talking and we said, okay, maybe what if we do this? So can we do this? Maybe. We don't know. But, you know, that seed was planted.
And this being what? Because I haven't said, you haven't said. This being what? What was the idea?
The idea was to promote the product.
Yeah.
And to show how strong, sturdy, and, you know, it could take on any sort of terrain. And at that time, the Paris-Dakar was the epitome of.
So you wanted to do Paris-Dakar with the bike?
We wanted to do Paris-Dakar.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, at that time, there was trouble brewing in Mali.
Right.
So we changed our plans, and then Honda said, you know what? We got a plant in Nigeria. How about we start from Algeria, from one of our dealers, so we can push the product there too. And then we went across from Algeria, no, from Morocco. Sorry, we started in Morocco, Algeria, Niger to Nigeria.
Wow.
It was about 10,000 kilometer long route. We gave ourselves about a month to do it. But our total riding time, we did it just in 17 days. So it was pretty amazing on a small 100cc bike with 10-inch wheels.
Oh my goodness. And that must have been
just
quite
so that everybody
great.
Gets an idea of what it was.
Yeah. How many
that
of
was
you
correct.
Were there?
We were a six-man team, so we had two scooters, and we had a Mercedes-Benz G-Wagon as our support car. It was a 240D diesel. It had just grunts and grunts of torque, wouldn't go too fast. And, you know, we being Indians, we planned everything looking at Michelin maps and Lonely Planet Guide.
That was
our planning. Tools. We had no clue. We were carrying suitcases instead of duffel bags. We had so much of luggage. It was quite funny, yeah. Because every time the scooters would get stuck, easy. Lift up the scooter, put it aside, and you carry on.
Yeah.
But if the G-Wagon got stuck, oh boy.
Did you have to unload it every time?
We have to unload every damn thing, get it out, carry all the stuff to the next point, and then load it again. It was killing.
And was it dangerous?
Not really, but there was a pretty, I got lost. So we were just about entering the desert from, it was the last point in Algeria, from Tamanrasset, yeah. That was the name of the town. From Tamanrasset, we are going across the desert into Niger. And we started off in the morning, and we had rear view mirrors on our bikes.
Yeah, cool.
yeah, I mean,
luxury.
Yeah, it was quite funny, yeah. So we started off, and the terrain was quite rutted. So what the French call tolandole. So it was really like one corrugated sheet.
Right.
And you're just going and just jazz your dentures right to your toes. And I didn't realize my friend on the other bike couldn't manage because of the sandstorm and everything blowing. He stopped because his rear view mirrors came loose.
Oh, right.
So he stopped to take them off. I didn't realize. I carried on. And with the wind noise and the, I didn't realize anything. I stopped after 10 minutes.
Uh-huh. Where is everyone?
360 degrees, not a soul.
Oh my God.
10 minutes. And then I carried on and I saw one trucker who was there at the border crossing in the morning because we had to register that we are going out in the desert, so in case of any problems. So I went and flagged them down. And I said, have you seen my friends? He said, yeah, he's doing this. I can't speak French.
Yeah.
He couldn't speak English. It was all sign language. So I said, I'm following you.
Yeah.
He said, okay. And we started off side by side. Then we brought wider. Next thing I know, I lost sight of him too.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And not that I was going fast. My bike could hardly do about 50 or 60 kilometers on a pretty... hard surface, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
And then I got lost, and then I saw this. There is a route which is marked, but nobody takes it because it's a car breaker. But I said I better follow it because I know I'm going in the right direction at least.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had nothing with me.
Yeah.
I had no water, no food.
Oh my Lord.
No nothing. No compass. Nothing. Just the fuel in my bike, and that's it.
Oh my God.
So I carried on, and I thought about Mark Thatcher in those days, 87 or 86, Mark Thatcher lost in the Paris-Dakar.
That's right, he did, yeah.
And I said, oh man, and then some people, and you see across, in the desert, you see these carcasses of vehicles just left to run. I said, that's going to be my fate, you know. It was scary. But then I saw in the distance, I saw a plume of smoke. And I saw vehicles, and it must have been a good, at least about 8 to 10 km from where I was. So I went across cross country, over dunes, running with the bike, because the bike didn't have much power. So every time I saw my bike is going to stall, run with it. I managed to make it because somebody had stopped, and it was a Volkswagen combi van with 4 Austrian students. And they were just absolutely shocked to see me jump out of nowhere. And I just collapsed, and when I came to, in those days I used to smoke, so I said, first thing I asked, I said, can you give me a cigarette?
Yeah.
I said, speak English? And they said, yeah. I said, oh, thank God, at least I can talk to somebody in English. And I had a couple of smokes from them, and nobody spoke, they're just watching me.
No water, cigarettes.
First cigarette, and then the water.
Right.
And then I said, look, you know what? I'm lost.
Yeah.
They said, oh, we are lost too. And I said, oh, shit, man, this is weird. Oh, so anyway, I said, do you have some petrol?
Because
I said, do you have gas?
Yeah.
Benzene, that's what they call it over there. Benzene, fluorescent. I said, thank God their Volkswagen, the van was petrol. So I borrowed some gas from them, put it in the my scooter, started off again, and half an hour riding, and we met their friends and my friends.
Oh my goodness.
And I got a bollocking for that. Instead of being happy to see me, I was saying,
was that from Adil then?
No, Adil was not there on the trip.
Right, okay.
You know what? When we went on the trip, Adil was busy getting married.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good get out excuse.
Yeah. So Yeah, but it was great. It was good fun. We had quite a few good memories from that trip. I mean, a lot of memories. Uh-huh. And it was great fun. And
would
I tell you, the scooter.
Would you do it again?
I would.
Really? Yep. Wow. That says a lot. Yeah. Of course, nowadays you'd have a phone and GPS, so you wouldn't. It'd be a whole different story. But
yeah, I think now it'll be much more easier.
Yeah.
But there'll be a proper route.
Yeah. To be honest. Yeah, it'd be a total different adventure. But talking adventures, then fast forwarding a little bit, how did you then end up in Dubai, where you've now been for 19 years?
Yeah, so my wife came to Dubai for a holiday.
Right.
And her uncle was here, her sister was here, and she came in for a holiday and she ended up getting a job. And uh-huh. she said, call me on the phone. I said, I'm not coming back. I said, oh, shite. I said, I better go there. So I had to come down to Dubai, look for a job. And and that's it. I still remember I got my job. My first job in Fleet Auto, it was December, and I spent Christmas Eve at the Iranian island. What's it called? I forgot the name also. So I went there, I spent Christmas Eve over there, Christmas Day, and then got the visa and came back. And started working in Fleet Auto magazine in those days.
Right.
And then there was Chandan Basu Malik, who was the editor over there.
Yeah.
And then we started Middle East Car magazine.
Right.
So
Chandan was on that, and then he started Middle East Car, and then of course he went to Autocar after that. So he started Middle East Car, right? Interesting.
So yeah. So we couldn't call it Car Middle East.
Yeah, because that was us.
That's why. Yeah. So yeah.
But we came later. We came later.
Y'all came in much later. Yeah.
We came in later. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was good fun. Mm-hmm. In those days, I still remember I didn't even have a license, and I went for, in those days we had a lot of private driving instructors.
Right.
And he said, look, I know you know how to drive, but please at least pay me for 10 lessons.
Right. Oh, right.
I need to make some money. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, fine, 10 lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and got my license the first time.
Yeah.
First time out. And my boss, who was a Lebanese guy, he was like shocked. He says, how can an Indian get a license in the first attempt?
Oh dear. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for the confidence boost, boss.
Yeah, exactly. But those days were good fun.
So then you did that for a while. So you did that, and then, you know, when I met you, you were not with that magazine, were you? You weren't with Middle East.
No, I was with Auto Middle East.
Right, Auto. Yeah, that's right. That's with Auto Middle East. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then in 2000, was it 2008? Is it? You then decided to go to the dark side.
2007. Yeah.
Right. Which was probably a smart move in retrospect, I guess. For sure,
definitely. No, I absolutely was spot on, and I went through some grief at that point, but it was all worth it. It was the right move to make at that point.
Uh-huh.
Never regretted it.
Uh-huh. And how's it been? How was the transition over to the PR side of the world from the journalist side?
Oh, it was pretty easy, I think. It was pretty easy. It was not that... I had some good colleagues and good people who sort of mentored me. Neil was there, obviously, but mainly it was Zach Matthew, who was our marketing manager at Daimler Chrysler that time.
Right.
Chrysler's went through so many different name changes. So, yeah, but it was great fun, you know.
Uh-huh. And what's been the highlights of being a PR guy for what later became FCA?
Oh, there were a lot of mainly doing events, launches, motor shows.
Yeah,
I've never worked so much as I've done for the four motor shows that I did.
Yeah. I swear you're the guy that, you know, I mean, if you had hair, you'd have torn it all out during motor shows. I've never seen somebody that is so cussing and blinding and freaking out and then actually enjoying it all at the same time.
Oh, no, it was, motor shows were damn good fun. I'm really sad that you know, they have died now. They're dead, pretty I mean, much. For sure, pretty much.
I mean, you saw the announcement about Geneva, right?
Geneva, yeah.
Which is tragic, absolutely tragic.
It is really tragic. Mm. Well... It's all thanks to new technology, isn't it?
Yeah. But the costs were escalating ridiculously, weren't they? I mean, you used to tell me about just in the Dubai Motor Show for FCA to be there, the costs were ridiculous, weren't they?
They were, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, but motor shows were good fun. I used to be the first guy in, last guy out.
Yeah.
Used to do it. And I loved it, you know, I loved the interaction with the media, love the interaction with the public, love the interaction with government entities. Yeah. It was great fun.
Yeah, like I said, you know, you tear whatever is non-existent hair out, but you really kind of, it's one of those things, you sort of thrive in that environment, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I remember that we at, I think it was 2011, we were giving away these tattoos of the Ram head.
Right.
That time it was the logo for Dodge.
Yeah, it was a Dodge Ram at the time.
And they were tattoos. We had made some tattoos and we were applying them for kids and stuff.
Yeah.
And somebody dared me that you won't put it on your head. And I said, do it now.
Yeah.
So I had a tattoo on the back of my head with a ram's head.
Yeah.
And every day I would put it, I'd put a fresh tattoo.
Yeah.
And people were thinking I'd really gone nuts because they said, why did you go and have a tattoo on your head? They thought it was real.
They're like, that's dedication.
Yeah,
that's like if you're gonna
maybe Jeep and Chrysler somewhere else.
If you're gonna be a PR guy, go all the way. You know?
Good, yeah, go all out, yeah.
but also, like, you know, it's, you know, if you're gonna be a PR guy, then I tell you what, it's a good brand to be PRing for, isn't it? It's some amazing products.
Absolutely, there's no doubt. I mean, the products. I remember when I joined, the products were not that good.
Yeah.
And I remember the MD asking me the one question. He says, even if you do not like our products, you need to give the right, you know, experience to the media. I said, yeah. So my personal views are not going to matter. I mean, I'm going to toe the company line. But at the same time, I would give the guys in the office some real serious, you know, criticism that this is not right or wrong and we need to improve. I can handle the media, but, you know, we need to let them speak their mind because that's the only way we'll be able to improve our products.
Yeah.
Most of the PRs, the minute you write something bad, I know because I was also one of y'all.
Yeah.
And I know the stick that we would get. And there were times when my boss used to say, why did you write something bad about this? I said, because it's crap. That's why. And said, no, you can't write.
Yeah.
So I never let that happen. The journals had their own opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that has stood us in good stead.
Yeah.
Because everybody knew that they could be honest about their opinions. And I would... in fact, insist on them being, you know, really honest about what they wrote.
But I always say that with PR, I think one of the most important things is actually the relationship. So, of course, coming from the journalist side, you knew all of the guys. You knew pretty much most of them. So that would probably have been a big, big advantage. You know, doing
Absolutely. It was a massive advantage. And a big thanks to all my media friends because they knew the situation I was in when I made the change. And everybody, quite a lot of them stepped up to the plate and you know, took all the cards that I threw at them.
Yeah.
And we were like, really, the cars were just not in my garage at all. They're coming in, going out, coming in, going out.
No, no, you're
all
very,
the time.
You're always very good with that, and you know, that's something that we benefited from a lot. So just before we go, because I always run out the clock with these things, because I always say, like, I'm going to do 30 minutes, and then I get caught up in the conversation we go over. But I'll tell you what, for people watching this, your top tips for anybody that's looking to get into automotive PR, what would you say were the three things? One is obviously the relationships, which
First is relationships. Second thing is the passion. You should love your cars, your bikes.
Yeah.
YouTube, Facebook, social media. Yeah. Everybody's an expert nowadays.
Yeah.
They're far more expert than you are and me I am.
Yeah.
That's not good enough.
Yeah.
You really need to have a lot of passion. You need not be a technical person.
Yeah.
But you need to have passion, and you need to know how to deal with people.
Yeah.
There have been times when you've seen me in action at times.
I certainly have.
But at the same time, I've always gone back and you know, put an arm around your shoulder or others, and you know, we have had a great laugh and we've got on with it.
Yeah. I think you've just put your finger on it. The other thing is, like, to realize not to take it too seriously, to realize that it's a fun thing. Let's enjoy ourselves.
So from the time that I started with PR, and there was always this big thing, it's press relations, it's public relations or what. So I told my boss, you know what, I don't care what everybody calls it, I'm going to call it personal relations.
Yeah.
Because at the end of it, if I build my personal relationships with the media, with whoever is coming in contact with our brands, that is a much better fix than anything else.
Yeah.
So that's how it helped me even during motor shows and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just go and talk to anybody. I would try to say, I was doing a job of salesman too.
Yeah,
you know?
No, you did.
That's
you
what
did.
It helps.
Yeah.
So passion is very important. Hard work.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Hard work.
Well, you're definitely one of the hardest working guys that I knew over there, both on this side of the media and on the other side of the media. And also, I have to also give you my thanks as well, because not only as a friend, but even on a professional level, you've always been incredibly supportive and encouraging. I mean, to some extent, Motoring Middle East, which we started, was started because of the encouragement we got from you. You know, I remember the very first conversation sitting in the ITP coffee area and talking about the project, and you were like, no, guys, you should do this, you know. So, yeah, no. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I have done my best to help everyone. Now you just don't see anyone. Everybody is gone. There are hardly any worthwhile media left.
Yeah.
And there are too many wannabes. So let's not talk about them, please.
We'll save that for the next episode. We'll come back around to that.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been absolutely fantastic. Thanks so much for doing this, and take care. Good love to all your family, and hope to speak to you again, man, soon.
Done. Cheers, mate. Thanks so much.
I just knew that was going to be fun to catch up with my good pal, Neville, over in the UAE. Wish him and his family all the best. Hope you enjoyed that. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments above, below, elsewhere. And let me know what you think of the series, Brown Car Guy and Buddies. I hope you've had a chance to catch the rest of them. Best thing to do is to subscribe to this channel, youtube.com/Brown Car Guy. Make sure you hit that bell notification icon so that you get updated every time I upload one of these videos. Whilst you're at it, make sure that you're following me on all the social media channels. Just search for #BrownCarGuy. That's on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And of course, subscribe to browncarguy.com. If you enjoy these videos, and if you can, head over to patreon.com/ShazadSheikh, and there you can support me. And if you do, there's some exclusive piece of content and some goodies there as well that you can get. If not, please continue to like, comment, share, subscribe. That's all very much appreciated. Thanks so much for watching, and I'll catch you again soon in the next one.